it's really a challenge when you're, especially coming back to your former congregation, I don't know what to preach. I never know what to preach. It's a real thing I go through. So I just said, I'm just going to preach the last sermon I preach in Escondido. You know, I think that'll work. I want to make sure that I'm a help to the ministry here. I want to make sure as I preach this that I am a help to Pastor Mark Stromberg and a help to the elders and the deacons and a help to you. That's my goal coming in. And so I thought that this last sermon, this last section that I preach in Escondido as I'm working through 1 Corinthians chapter 13 would be something that we all need to hear, I need to hear. I was greatly convicted as I preached it of how much we need to be reminded of this, and a good message to come to the table this morning. So I invite you to turn in the scriptures this morning to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. The well-known passage on love. And we'll consider the entirety of the passage, which I have titled the sermon, The More Excellent Way. This is the word of the Lord. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will fail. Where there are tongues, they will cease. Where there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, and love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. May the Lord bless the hearing of his word. I want to consider with you this morning one of the most beautiful passages, I believe, in the New Testament in terms of it's just a glorious masterpiece written by the Apostle Paul under inspiration of the Spirit. It stands out so sharply because it really does come to us in a book, in a church that is full of conflict. And if you were to go through and preach this book and read through this book, you'd realize, man, this is one problem after another that this church was going through, and bad stuff, really bad stuff. But then you come to chapter 13, and from a literary perspective, it's one of the greatest passages Paul ever penned. It really is. It makes you feel as a pastor that if you say anything by way of explanation, you're just going to wreck its sheer beauty. One pastor once said that too much analysis will attract from its beauty and its power. I think that's right. The challenge is that such a passage is often ripped out of context. I don't know how many times I've preached it for a wedding. Everyone wants it for a wedding. And it's a wonderful wedding passage, but it never really is then appreciated for where it stands and why it was given where it is given and inspired where it is inspired. It's only appreciated when we understand and look at the context into which this comes and what Paul is particularly dealing with in the church of Corinth. The section comes in a teaching of the Apostle Paul on spiritual gifts. Spiritual gifts. If you were to summarize the problem in this particular section, which really does run from chapters 12 to 14 here, The church didn't understand and didn't appreciate what it meant that God had specifically taken each member and formed them as the body of Christ, which was expressed locally in the church where God had put them. They didn't understand that. They didn't appreciate that. They were functioning a lot as little islands to themselves. But in chapter 7, the apostle said, and he made clear, that he was beginning to answer a bunch of questions that the Corinthians had particularly asked him about certain problems that were happening in the church. And one of those particular issues had to do with the gift of tongue speaking, speaking in tongues. They were curious about it. There was known at the time different practices called ecstasy and enthusiasts. They were called enthusiasts who would speak in tongues, and this was had nothing to do with the church. And this stuff started to be borrowed from the culture, and they knew that Pentecost, this gift which was known languages, they knew that that gift was an operation in the first century, but in Corinth it was showing up as a bunch of gibberish, which it was never intended to be. Tongues were a known language. So these extraordinary gifts and what began to happen, and you really see how this fits the modern church, what began to happen is everyone started looking at super spiritual people as having the real powerful spiritual gifts, and there were the superheroes. There were the really powerful ones. There were the ones who were really doing something in the kingdom and in the church. Those who received what they thought were the greatest gifts got the greatest praise from men, and then you had a bunch of spectators who sat back and all wished they could do that gift, even getting a bunch of people trying to do that gift themselves. See, nothing has changed with the airplanes. Spectator ministry is what began to happen. And the whole body was suffering because they didn't understand and appreciate that God takes and puts a body together, and he went and explained in chapter 12 that the body functions as a whole. When one part of the body is lacking and one part of the body is hurting, it affects the whole, even the little toe. He explained all those things in chapter 12 about the importance of how God fits together the body, and he said, gifts are not for you, but they're for the common good of the body. Corinth had developed, it really is an amazing church to study for our time, a rock star mentality when it came to gifts. Paul says, your gifts are for the common good. I want you to look, though, at the end of chapter 12 with me for a moment. And I want you to look at the end where he's basically saying not everyone has these gifts. He ties them up to the offices, the offices there of apostles and prophets. But I want you to look at verse 30 of chapter 12. Do all have gifts of healings? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? And the answer, of course, is no. Not everyone has those gifts. But earnestly desire the best gifts. And yet I show you a more excellent way. Read as there, he says there, earnestly desire the best gifts. How should that be read? As an indicative or as an imperative? I take that, it's hard to tell in the original, I take that it could be read as this way, but you guys are earnestly desiring the best gifts, what you think are the great gifts, but I've got a more excellent way for you. You guys are all set on what you think are the really big gifts. You desire those. But let me show you something else. Let me show you a way that's way better. And that takes us to chapter 13. What is that way? It's love. It's love. This was a church without love. Fascinating and scary thing to say, isn't it? This was a church without love. It's a little bit like Ephesus, I suppose, when the Lord had said to them they had left their first love, and whatever had happened in that church, it wasn't that they left Jesus, it was that whatever had inspired them when that church began, whatever kind of overflow of good works came out when that church was formed. It was gone. And a similar kind of problem has happened here in Corinth. And Paul is explaining something to them. Paul's explaining that without love, nothing matters of what you do. He's explaining this, and he's providing this to correct priorities in the life of this church, but also to inspire them in their service and conviction of how they function in the body. And Paul calls them ultimately in all pursuits as Christians to pursue the one gift, the greatest gift, that is permanent. That's what I want to emphasize to you this morning. The gift that is permanent. Paul says that essentially in verse 8 when he says, you'll notice there, love never fails. It means ends. Love never ends. It never stops. It never goes away. And you think, well, why is he making that point? That's what I want you to see this morning. Paul wanted the church in Corinth to understand that God's greatest gift to the church was love, because it has a permanent quality. And to understand that, then he launches into a teaching on love that is just profound and just beautiful. And I have to say up front, I suppose we have to clear away just for a moment all the baggage that surrounds that word love. I'm always nervous in preaching something like this because I never know how people hear it. Certain people hear it and think, well, that's right. All we need is love, and therefore we can't critique anything. We can't ever say anything's wrong. I mean, you get all this weird stuff when it comes to love. We act like we're Beatles or something. All we need is love. In most cases, when people say all we need is love, they're speaking of it romantically. There's even worship songs that are romantic in their love about Jesus, which is entirely inappropriate and weird, by the way. The word for love is, in some places, is the word eros, which is associated with a sexual kind of love. Another word for love is philios, which is more of a sharing love, a familial love, a love of the family that you all enjoy with family. But Paul purposely chose the word that you all know well, and we talk about it a lot. It's the word agape. Agape love, which is a sacrificial kind of love. A love that shows true Christian character, because it's the most difficult thing for us to exercise. Why? Well, I want you to think with me for a moment about love and how God taught us love. Remember 1 Thessalonians 4, where the Apostle Paul said something here, "For you yourselves are taught by God to love one another." God taught you that. Remarkable statement. Jesus, of course, that came from when Jesus told them, "A new commandment that I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another." That's going to be how people know you belong to me, is your love that you show for one another. It's agape love that he chose there to use. A new commandment. Not because there never was love before, but because I came down off my throne and I taught you what love is. I showed you as my children what love looks like. I taught you by example. I showed you true love. What did it look like? Well, the Father didn't spare his own son for you. Jesus said in John 16, "The Father loves you because you've loved me." It's one thing to say we love and another thing to demonstrate that we love. And here is where we learn love. Here's where we understand love. Jesus taught it that. Jesus taught us love when in John 13 he stood up at the table and he tied the towel around himself and he went up and he got down on his knees and he washed his disciples' feet. We'll never plumb and understand the depths of that. That was God incarnate getting on his knees, washing our feet. Selfless. Denial of the self completely. Emptying of the self. Promotion of the interests of others. Loving when hated. Giving when scorned. Providing when despised. Sacrificing when no one asked. Oh, you're taught by God to love. It's not sentimental. It's not armchair stuff. It's love in action. back to Corinth. What Paul does here is use the greatest manner of exaggeration at this point to emphasize the value of love in the life of the church. And as I was going through this, I thought, well, there really are three categories here that we could summarize this, three categories that we could summarize and put this together. And I came up with this. I came up with the greatest voice, the greatest mind, excuse me, and the greatest giver. I want you to look then again at verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Now, he chose that first because, remember, tongue speaking was the major problem going on in Corinth. If I was able to use the tongues of angels when I spoke and when I preach, if I had the greatest preaching voice ever, if I had the greatest communicative abilities ever given to a man, remember, Paul was criticized for not being able to speak well. The church was caught up in all the excellent orators of the day, all the great speakers of the day. They were so enthralled. They'd talk about who was the great preacher. Well, that's what we need. That's what we need. That's what we need. If I had that, if I had the greatest orator that ever existed, if I was, they called the greatest preacher in the early centuries of the church, his name was Chrysostom, Golden Mouth Chrysostom. They called him Golden Mouthed. I guess he spit out gold. If I was so eloquent, I sounded like the best piece of musical instrumentation ever, but have not love, I'm nothing. You ever heard people bang together gongs and cymbals? I could try to make the worst noise ever right now. I won't try. It's no profit. It's what it's like. Then Paul does something shocking. One pastor said, then he really kicks the sacred cow. You know a lot about cows. The greatest mind. If I had a beautiful mind, if I could prophesy, I mean, I could really bring it. If I have the ability to put together the scriptures like no one else, man, that guy can bring it home. If I have all knowledge, I've read all the fathers. If I have put it all in there, man, let me tell you, if I put it all into my brain, if I know so much and I have learned so much and I understand so much, I understand all the mysteries of the faith. I've got it all together. And faith itself, I mean, I'm a pillar. When everyone knows me, there's a pillar. That man's strong. That's what they think. If I appeared to be the greatest, see how he's using exaggeration here, the greatest theologian, I appeared so strong to everyone that I could move mountains. I'm a fountain of wisdom. I've got a beautiful mind. But no love? Useless. You are absolutely useless in the kingdom. How about this? What if you were the greatest giver? What if you gave all your goods to feed the poor? Any of you willing to do that? What if you were willing to go down into ISIS territory, say, I believe in Jesus, and give your body, and you know your head's coming off? Whoa, wait, let's go to the first century. What if you're willing to get put on the chopping block, and you're willing then to be put up there with the hay bales and set on fire? Do you know, Paul says here, you could be willing to do that with your body and still not have love? You could offer your body to martyrdom and be proud in doing it. I'm doing that. Greatest mind, greatest voice, greatest giver. All of it, he says, is in vain. Now, you had all these people in Corinth who could do some marvelous things. You had these people in Corinth who were all caught up in the marvel of a ministry where all the great stuff could be done. And they didn't understand what was happening to the church. That wasn't for the common good. There was no sense of the common good. There was no sacrificial love happening anymore. It was all about me, how I feel when I come, what it's like, who sounds the best. Their service was selfish. It was sad fruits going on. And I thought to myself, when the church is functioning as it should, what's promoted? Love. When it's not, you get what was happening in Corinth. This was a book, a church full of major problems. What was it? Well, you had factions. You had pride. You had spiritual superhero worship going on. When there was no love, what was missing is that there was no love, and therefore, then nobody used their gifts anymore because they looked at the really spiritual ones and thought, well, that's where the real value in the kingdom is. What could I ever do that would matter? That's not love. There was no building up. There was no unified working to build up. You know, you could say this about your own life. When love is not functioning as it should, your life is probably full of division and fighting and separation with family, all sorts of stuff. Go right down the line. No love. It wasn't the problem of the gift. It was the application of the gift. Why does God give great orators? Why does God give preachers? Well, when it becomes about the preacher, then it's no longer about the people. They've lost what it's about. If you're a Puritan precisionist and you can parse all the verbs in Greek and Hebrew and you think it's all for knowledge, why do you think you were given that? So that you can go around proving the correctness of it all? No. He says here, when that kind of rightness of it all is divorced from the blessing of a mind to help, a mind that struggles in understanding, you're puffed up. That's what he's saying here. I've been guilty of all this. I'm going to say that right up front. Offering your body to martyrdom. You know, Muslims do this all the time, thinking they're doing something, don't they? Followers of Jesus might think that. And they do it with a kind of martyr complex. You know what a martyr complex is? Martyr complex is, you know, I'm going to it, and I'm one of the last ones standing. It's all a kind of test, I thought. It's so important for us to hear another URC minister on this, and I want to quote the words. I think they're so helpful. In my estimation, the primary sin of Christians in our Reformed tradition is pride. We're convinced we're right about doctrine. Everyone else is looked down upon condescendingly. We may be right about our doctrine, but we cannot forget Paul's words, also a doctrine, to the effect that if we have not love for our brothers and sisters, even when we think them wrong, we're nothing but windbags and noisy gongs. Kim Riddlebarger. Amen. I've had to learn that. When I went into ministry, I thought I'd be fighting all the terrible doctrines of the mega churches, you know. And it's bad stuff. Don't let anyone tell you differently. But I started there, and then I saw in the Reformed tradition, the strict Reformed tradition, so much fighting. So much sectarian behavior. So much people, Christians, fighting over things Christians should not fight over. Or handle in a completely different manner. I watched the next generation bolt out of the church. This is what we've seen happen. and they're bitter. And then we stand back as the truly reformed with a martyr complex. We're the last 5,000 that have not bowed down the knee to Baal, man. We're the last 5,000. We are standing on the truth. We're the last of the elect, by the way. Seen that? Terrible spirit of our times. Just a sad time, sad time. It is a sad time. But are we just fighters? I've long been concerned. I'm reformed because I believe the doctrine's right. And don't let anyone hear me, boy, I think we should be checking books out of the library, and I think we should be obtaining a lot more knowledge. I'm afraid that when you preach a sermon like this, then everyone starts to think, well, see, knowledge is bad. Knowledge is not the problem. You need knowledge. You need to go check out books. You need to read theology. You need to grow. You need to understand. That's not the problem. It's what you do with it. Do you realize what Paul's saying here? What you have is not for you. Whatever God gave you, whatever gift he gave you, it's not for you. He didn't give it for you. He gave it for the person sitting next to you. It's easier to be orthodox and loving. You know that? One pastor said, right theology is no substitute for love. There is a regulative principle, explicit here, that we need to be balanced. Be balanced, and that's a challenge. That's so hard to be balanced. That's something we have to pray for. Elders have to pray for in the life of a church. But it's the Holy Spirit's commandment here to balance everything by love. That means that when I'm a member of the church, I don't look at the church and say, well, those people are to this or that, or those people are hard to love, or those people on and on and on. Instead, God gave you a gift to love those hard people. And maybe you're the hard one. No, not me. This is where Paul's doctrine takes us. God taught us love. So Paul now describes love as it should function in the body. This is so beautiful. Verse 4, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. Does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. They so speak for themselves. It's hard to even comment this morning. But I want us to see it in context. The whole thing here, Paul is saying, this is how love should function in the body. And this is, when a body's functioning healthy, this is what it looks like. This is what's built up. This is what's happening. You could sum it up by saying, true love has its defining characteristic a denial of yourself. It's putting the interests of others other than you, over you. Its design here is to conform how we live to the image of Jesus, who denied himself the whole time he was here. It's true that 1 Corinthians 13 is sort of love personified. It's like we have a giant portrait of Jesus right in front of us. There's no doubt about that. It's a portrait of his love. One pastor said that. Here he is sitting, and this is what we see on that portrait, the love of Christ. This is how he treated us when you read this. This is what we know when you read this. This is how it gives us access to the table this morning, because he loved us like this. But walk with me through it for a moment. Love is patient. It doesn't get upset or frustrated with people when they see or do things or disagree with them. It stands back and it looks at the bigger picture, and it's patient with them. It doesn't get angry. It controls its anger. It doesn't avenge itself. Instead, this love is it's kind. Its concern is the well-being and the happiness of others. It doesn't envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. You notice how there's a spirit behind it? When somebody's not loving, there's a spirit there. There's an attitude. sometimes in conflict, when the conflict supposedly is over, you always feel that this person, people have really never let it go. They're going to somehow keep digging. Sometimes when people have convictions, you know, it's a separation, and because of the arrogance of the person, they separate out and they want nothing to do with another person. Love doesn't insist on its own way. Well, that's a big one. Not trying to push an agenda. It's willing to yield. That's a characteristic of an elder, by the way. Not push an agenda, but willing to yield. Love despises when people do wrong. It doesn't parade it. It's ready instead to rejoice and celebrate when something good has happened, when there's truth. It bears all things. It doesn't run away. Its disposition in the midst of interactions with others is to bear with them and love them and hope the best, never hope the worst. It's willing to stay the course with somebody and endure and not run away. Are you convicted? I am. I can go through everyone and say I failed. And the Lord holds that out for us today and says, I've loved you. Paul, what he's doing here is prioritizing, reprioritizing the church. And says something so important to the main point. Love never ends. That word is so important to retain their ends. It doesn't have an ending point. It doesn't have a stopping point. I love this. Agape love, sacrificial love, it never tips over. It never falls down, you could translate it as. It has a permanent quality. It has a permanent quality when we exercise it. Are you understanding what happened in Corinth now? They're all stuck in the temporary stuff. They're all interested in the things that fall over, and their actions show it. I mean, this is what he's essentially saying in verses 8 through 10. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. He mentions three gifts there: prophecies, knowledge, and tongues. Notice what he does. He uses the same verb for knowledge and prophecies. You could see it right there. He uses the same verb to say, those two will pass away. Knowledge and prophecies will pass away. Something will bring them to an end. What is it? When I was in school, and I was a child, I asked my parents for a Walkman. Anybody remember those? A Walkman. And I thought, that's just the greatest thing ever. A Walkman, you could put a little tape in there and walk around and listen to music, you know. Your kids ask for Walkmans today? Oh, they want MP3 players, they want a phone, which I told my kids no, by the way. There's a time coming when prophecies and knowledge will be brought to an end. Why? Well, because you don't need them, because something so much greater has come. It just is over. When the perfect, he links those two verbs to the perfect. Notice that he says it there really clearly. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. What's the perfect? Well, what are you looking for? The perfect. It's not that hard to figure out. You're looking for a time when there's no more of this. You're looking for a time where there's no more hardship and suffering and a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness shall dwell and you'll have no more sin. Can you imagine that? The ministry will be done. Tongues, different verb, will just stop, will cease. Well, when? Universally, it was accepted that when the apostles died, it just stopped. It was like a battery that ran out. It was only for a time necessary for the church to get off the ground before the cannon came. Tongues just stopped. It was done. It doesn't have another need. Now, the church in Corinth is all interested in the tongue stuff. They're all interested in the supernatural gifts. They're all interested in the wow factor ministry. And in that, who was pursuing what mattered the most? It's tragic. And by the way, I had no agenda in this. I assure you, I preached this to my church last week. It's tragic when a church leaves its first love. When you get factions and hero worship valuing the things that the world values and obsessed with speaking abilities and divisions and then all the divisions and fighting that goes on and arguments over disputes over words and people pushing agendas. All this stuff dominates church life. You want to know what a church without love looks like? Read all the problems in Corinth. Problem after problem after problem after problem. Paul's setting right the priorities in a church which fixes all the problems. When you look at a church that's not operating well, it's not moving forward, it's caught up in all the wrong stuff. That's what it is. It's caught up in all the wrong stuff. How do you go forward? What's Paul's point? Well, you guys love the tongues. You guys love the wow stuff. I mean, what could we substitute that with today? You love the stuff that you think has all the power, but it was designed to stop. That's not going into eternity. You're caught up in the enthusiasm. That was a first century phenomenon. The ecstasy, first century phenomenon. It's all temporary. And Paul's point is to say, is what you're pursuing in the life of the church, does it have eternal value? You're not here for you. You're here for God's glory, and the gifts that he pours out and gives to you are for someone else. Imagine if we all thought like that. Paul says, when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, and I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. Paul's saying, listen, you can live like a child. You could live. My daughter said the other day, oh, Dad, I just can't wait when I get old, and I can just eat candy all the time. I said, you're not going to do that. You don't do that. It'd make you feel bad, wouldn't you? But kids don't realize that. They think like children. It's kind of like you have to tell your child to share the toy. You have to constantly say, share the toy, share the toy. I guess when we're old, we can still not share the toys. But Paul is saying here, when we think and we're holding on in the ministry to what's temporary, we're thinking like children. It's like you just want the cotton candy. You know you need the meat. You know you need the peas. You know you need the squash. And so what he's saying here is this. All of our service in the life of the kingdom, we use certain things. We use the gifts. But all of it is subservient to love. Why? Because love is lasting. You can do something that has eternal lasting value. What is God's greatest gift to the church? You ever thought about that? I'm not talking about Christ. I'm talking about as Christ was ascended in a state of exaltation and pours out gifts from heaven, what's his greatest gift to the church? It's love. He taught you it. And what was being sacrificed in Corinth? The greatest gift to the church. So now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, but the greatest of these is love. In our earthly life, here are three great things: faith, hope, and love. You're not going to need faith in eternity. You're not going to need hope in eternity. You've got your hope. Love goes. Love goes. And so in chapter 14, the first thing he says is pursue love. Instead of all the other stuff, why don't you start there? It takes a real denial of yourself. And ask yourself why all the conflict, maybe in your own life, is there. Because there's no love. A Christian is never more ready. You ever wonder, how could I be ready for Jesus to come again? You're never more ready for the eternal state. You're never more ready for heaven than when you're practicing something that has an eternal characteristic, character like this. God's desire was always honoring the commandment out of love from a sincere heart, and that's what the new covenant gave you, a regenerated heart to love, because Christ has loved you. That never ends. Never ends. You're going to come right now to the table. Time's up. You're going to come right now to the table, and he's going to tell you, I love you. That's what this is for. Imagine as you go out from here if Jesus said tomorrow, I am so tired of them messing up. I would be devastated if I thought Christ's not going to bear with me tomorrow. I wouldn't endure if he refused to no longer be patient and kind to me. I can't imagine when I broke his law if he says, that's it! Done! You call me teacher and Lord, you're right. So I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, this is what I'm doing for you today, you ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do just as I've done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant's not greater than his master. Don't go around claiming, well, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. Don't do that. You're united to Jesus. You're not greater than your master. If you know these things, you are a truly blessed person in the Christian life if you do them. You can't do that yourself. I'm not saying that. You're truly blessed if this characterizes your life. You understand that? I'm not saying you will be blessed if. I'm saying you are blessed if this characterizes your life. That's gospel. Since Christ has loved you with an everlasting love, we should ask, does this same kind of agape love characterize our life? That'll make for such a healthy church. That'll make for a church that's a light. That'll make for a church that is a bright, shining light in a community. A new commandment I give to you, that you should love one another as I have loved you. You ought also to love one another. By this, all people will know you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Let's pray.